Welcome to the second part of an interview with Hudson Structured Capital Management's founder and managing partner, Michael Millett. This is the Insurer's Best Policy podcast, and my name is Christopher Munro. If you listen to the first half of this interview, you'll have heard Michael give his thoughts on what has piqued investors' current interest in the insurance and reinsurance market as the industry prepares to welcome a spate of new cos, the equity raises undertaken by existing companies, and the potential for new sidecars to be formed and some of the potential hurdles in their path. In the second part of the interview, we take a broader look at some of the opportunities on the horizon. We discuss the ILS market and what Michael describes as a very awkward adolescence for that sector. We also talk about the potential fallout and impact on the insurance and reinsurance industry from the COVID-19 outbreak. There are various potential solutions being talked about to support businesses in the future should they face pandemic-related losses, and Michael shares his thoughts on these. He also gives his opinion that COVID-19 will force a reckoning on issues surrounding trapped capital. But I begin by asking Michael about the seemingly strong prospects that are apparent in the casualty legacy market.
Historically, the legacy casualty market has been reasonably disciplined. The legacy casualty market is growing, and it's growing for a couple of reasons. One is that the way that companies use the legacy casualty market is shifting. In the past, they would use it to take on an especially difficult block of business that a company would reinsure, that they wouldn't have to talk about it anymore with their constituencies. They would typically take a bath in reinsuring it, but they would put a problem behind them. We call that cathartic runoff activity. That's what the old runoff market was all about. You shed a line of business and you announced that you had taken a bath, but it was gone and your equity analysts cheered. The new and improved legacy casualty market is different. We believe that it's become hygienic, a normal activity of life. Companies will seek to take mature blocks of business, shift them into the legacy casualty market where they can be invested differently, capitalized differently, taxed differently, in every case more efficient, and then primary companies can move their capital onto new business. So we believe that this tendency was going on anyway before coronavirus. As in so many things, corona will be an accelerant. Companies will have taken losses, will find themselves continuing to take losses over the next 2 years or so, we expect, and they can raise equity or they can recover equity from their legacy blocks of business. So we expect that the volumes in legacy casualty will pick up. There were already a whole series of companies that were near runoff or in runoff before coronavirus, and those companies will seek quicker resolution. That'll be another source of growth in the legacy casualty market. So we believe that this is a disciplined market that was growing anyway and that will now accelerate. There are about 10 companies in the market, and they have been building capital at a deliberate pace, so we're happy to participate.
Where do you think the sort of bulk of the opportunities will arise? I mean, North America, Europe, Lloyd's, London, more generally, Bermuda perhaps. Are there any areas where you think there is ripe for this sector?
Accounting firms have done careful analysis of that in the past, and opportunities have appeared and grown all around the world. I do expect that that'll continue to be the case. If anything, I would expect to see a pickup, especially in Europe. If we look at the $80 billion of coronavirus losses, I expect that the bulk of the trade credit losses will hit in Europe, and that's maybe the largest component of losses. I expect that actually quite a bit of the business interruption loss will ultimately hit in Europe, where the wordings seem less careful about excluding virus than they do in North America. And then there are lines of business like cargo and event cancellation / contingencies that seem to be somewhat more popular in the European markets than in Bermuda or North America. So I would expect that that will drive many of the European companies to seek this market.
Just looking ahead, though, from Hudson Structured's point of view, in terms of new investment opportunities on the horizon, what other areas are you seeing at the moment that are piquing your interest?
Well, we improved transactions this week in both cyber and intellectual property, collateralized reinsurance in each. And I'm happy that we have engaged with those markets and that we are transacting in those markets, because those are significant growth markets for the future for the industry. The industry's past is around insuring physical assets. Part of the problem the industry is having with business interruption now is that the industry married business interruption to its notion of physical loss and didn't quite understand the extent to which companies' priorities had changed and where events would drive companies' priorities such that companies really need protection against business interruption free of physical damage. Business interruption from pandemic, business interruption from cyber, from outage. Intellectual property and cyber are growth areas for the future. We're engaging in them. It's not a big part of our portfolio, but it's an area for growth. As I said, we think that business interruption is going to be another important topic for the industry. It can be quantified. You know, you can take business interruption coverage and decompose it into BI from pandemic, BI from NatCat, BI from systemic cyber, BI from idiosyncratic cyber. You can think about how to model each of those elements, develop an unknown unknowns component for BI, and then you can start to creep toward a CBI model. The industry needs to be doing those sorts of things. This is part of the reason that we're also engaging with firms that are involved in that modeling. You mentioned a cyber modeling firm before that we've invested in. This is important to the future of the industry, and we're not just altruistic. We're investing for our LPs. We expect that this is where the growth is.
Shifting direction somewhat, I'd like to talk to you about the ILS market, alternative capital, third-party capital, whatever name it's given these days. What is your current thought on that space at the moment? There was talk of redemptions earlier on this year. However, at the same time, there's also talk that now may be a boon period for the sector. You know, there's a lot of opportunity out there, potential to invest in that space. Can you give me a sort of state of play at the market of that segment at the moment and where you see opportunities there as well, please?
Let's define terms. I think by the ILS market, you're really referring to the complex of funds that invest about one-third of their capital in catastrophe-linked bonds and about two-thirds of their capital in catastrophe-linked reinsurance. There are other ILS markets. Properly speaking, the runoff market is an ILS market, although people don't tend to think of it that way. But let's focus on the big catastrophe complex, which, after all, is about two-thirds unsecuritized CRI or collateralized reinsurance. That sector has grown at a rapid pace since Hurricane Katrina. The day before Katrina hit, the funds as a group in that market were maybe $6 billion, and the bond market was a couple billion. And now the bond market and the funds in that area are $100 billion. So in 15 years, that is, you know, 15 times growth. It's an amazing growth rate. And the reason for that growth is initially the sector demanded capital because of the needs after Katrina. Secondarily, the sector rewarded that capital by performing well in the financial crisis. And then that sector rewarded that capital again by having about a 10-year period relatively free of catastrophes. We are now in what I think is very likely an awkward adolescence for that sector. We've had 4 years of loss experience. It hasn't always been crisply or perfectly modeled. Some funds have produced extremely disappointing experiences for their LPs. LPs are eager, the limited partners, the LPs, are eager for the diversification that the sector can involve, but they want to have better assurance that they understand the quantity of risk that they're taking and that they're getting paid appropriately. There will be, I expect, a shakeout. Investors will demand more from funds. Mm-hmm. Some funds will grow, others will not. And that isn't a surprise. You know, we had fund after fund after fund appear, including the entities that I worked with my team to create. But we had fund after fund appear and grow and do that during a period of relatively light catastrophe experience. So now is the reckoning. I expect that as investors go through that thought process, the sector will move sideways. The sector essentially has moved sideways since Hurricane Harvey. The sector hit $100 billion shortly after Harvey Irma Maria, and it's still at about that level today. It stopped growing as investors think, as funds think. But I think that as investors consider their experience in better funds, as investors consider their priorities around non-correlation, as they consider the attractiveness of the broad reinsurance market following coronavirus, that we will see fresh growth in a more mature way.
In terms of new opportunities, there's been talk that things such as pandemic bonds or pandemic cap bonds may come to the fore in response as a way of investors getting into the market, but also of insurers and reinsurers looking to offset some exposure related to future pandemic losses. Do you see a potential market there?
Pandemic is tricky. For one thing, as we've seen, pandemic is one insurance risk that is very highly correlated to broader capital markets. So it doesn't enjoy the same quality of risk that causes investors to favor other parts of the insurance market. And funds need to be careful about that. You know, the reason that investors seek this area out is for that low correlation. So we're guarded around pandemic risk. In some ways, pandemic risk is, you know, very well hedged through a short on major market indices. That doesn't make it first choice for lots and lots of LPs. Of course, you know, investors in this market have actuarial capabilities, quantitative tools to think about these risks, to price these risks. But I'm not certain that the funds are going to attract a lot of investor attention by taking a lot of pandemic risk. That's the first issue. The second issue is, you know, the industry spends a lot of time talking about risks that are hard for the industry to insure and about the need for government to step in. And honestly, I'm usually pretty cynical. I think the insurance industry can do a lot more than it says it can. We've all heard speeches about how the industry can't insure certain super catastrophes, it can't insure terrorism. I think the industry should be able to absorb many of those risks. But pandemic, I wonder about. Business interruption losses in the United States run about $300 billion a month. The industry's capital would be run through quickly. It may be that pandemic losses are losses that truly do need some sort of government intervention. I'm very interested in the efforts of companies in both the U.S. Congress and in the London market to think about public-private solutions for pandemic risk.
Are any of those public-private solutions to pandemic risk, do any of them strike you as perhaps more viable than others?
Yeah, let me grind an axe here. I hate mini policies. Let's stop it with the mini policies. I think that the mini policies are one of the worst ideas that the industry has developed over the past 30 years. And what I mean by that is creating a special entity to issue a special kind of policy risk with the intent that that risk will flow to a different entity like the government. Why hate mini policies? Because the minute you create a mini policy, then you have a new issue, which is take-up rates. Insurance is hard enough for people to buy. It's harder for them to keep track of all the different types of insurance they're supposed to buy. And when you create mini policies to carry specific types of risk, you're proliferating the number of insurance decisions that individuals and firms need to make, and you're going to have more incidences of uncovered risk. You know, we have companies that advocate for mini policies and at the same time, you know, prattle on in the market about uncovered risks. We responded to the lack of shake coverage in California by creating mini policies. And look what we have now. Over 80% of Californian homeowners don't have shake insurance. We responded to flood. Harry Truman responded to flood by creating the NFIP, which is brilliant, except A, it's always bankrupt, and B, many, many, many people in flood zones don't have the mini policy. So what should we do? Should we simply have pandemic coverage flow through normal insurance coverage and have insurance companies have the facility to reinsure that into public-private entities or schemes? Or should we create a new class of pandemic mini policies? I think you understand my view. I think if we create new pandemic mini policies, all sorts of people won't take them up, and then we'll have another pandemic, and then we're going to have a public policy crisis because those people insist they didn't understand it, or the agents were unclear, or the companies were unclear, and there should be some sort of bailout scheme.
I really wanted to get your thoughts on the issue of trapped capital and whether there may be some issues surrounding that emanating from COVID-19 losses or potential COVID-19 losses. What is your take on that at the moment?
I think that Corona will force a reckoning on trapped capital. Trapped capital has become a more and more important issue since the 2017 storms. It really wasn't much of an issue before that. Part of the reason that trapped capital has become such a big issue is because social inflation has caused companies to become very insecure about estimating how much of a loss they will ultimately take in an event. So they will estimate one number, but they'll be conscious that assignment of benefits lawyers or exploding loss adjustment expenses or dubious flood claims or business interruption or riot may drive those claims sharply higher in the future. And so what they do for comfort is they trap capital. The problem is that there's going to be less and less capital to trap. The supply of sidecar capital that is offered is diminishing in part because of this. The supply of retro capital that is offered is diminishing in part because of this. So companies will need to find crisper ways to agree to and settle trapped capital if they're going to have that capital made available to them in the first place. This dialogue has been a little bit of a one-way dialogue over the past 3 years, where companies trapped capital in part because of their insecurity and in part extravagantly, but they are starting to find genuine shortages in sidecar and retro sectors, and this is how those shortages will be resolved. One cynical way to deal with trapped capital is to trap capital until investors roll over. Investors have seen this game play out a couple times before. I think that companies that do that are going to find their access to capital will start to diminish in consequence. So I think that the industry had a lot of leeway around trapped capital. It used all of that leeway, and now there will actually be a reckoning. Where we will see that reckoning settle will be in the sidecar market. In order to clear sidecars through the market, companies are going to have to agree to some genuine metrics on capital trapping. For example, they'll have to agree, I expect, that they will only be able to trap capital that is tied to their accounting statement losses. And the buffer tables that they'll have to use to do that will be much harder edged.
Just finally, really, you mentioned AOB and some of the issues down in relating to Florida there. Just curious about you looking at a review from the renewal a couple of weeks ago. I know you've been very vocal on some of your thoughts on the Florida market and how price rises are not the only way of solving the issues there, far from it, in fact. But I'd be curious to hear whether the changes down in Florida meant that it was an area that perhaps Hudson Structure might take more an interest in the future. I know you don't have a heavy participation in that sector, but were any of the changes at June 1st enough to maybe sort of tempt your interest in the future?
Well, no, we are eager to be helpful, and we're very engaged with the Florida market, and we've invested in a whole series of companies there, typically at the holding company level, as opposed to the reinsurance programs. So we value our relationships with companies in Florida a great deal. The reinsurance market has had two issues that we focused on. One is alignment, and one is probabilities. On the alignment front, we believe that we have seen renewed attention to co-participation, to non-cascading covers, to loss adjustment expense limits. Those are all positive. On the probability side, we really do need to pay more attention to squaring stochastic probabilities in real events. We saw multiple programs this year where Hurricane Irma showed up as the 1 in 100 event or higher. In one case, Irma exhausted a supposed 1 in 250 cover. We can see 6 to 8 events larger than Irma in the past century. I mean, they're visible in Florida. You know, 26, 28, 44, probably 47, maybe, certainly Andrew, certainly Donna. So, you know, showing up and saying, you know, my program goes to 1 in 100 and it was exhausted from Irma is a non sequitur, and it raises questions about the probabilities and pricing top to bottom. So we'd like to see those sums worked hard, and we work those sums hard in making underwriting decisions. I'm happy to say that we have done some underwriting, and you know, we always value the chance to review and perhaps participate in Florida programs. But those are the issues that we need to think through.
That brings us to an end of the second part of the Insurers the Best Policy podcast interview with Michael Millett, Hudson Structured Capital Management's founder and managing partner. On behalf of my colleagues at the Insurer, thank you for your time, Michael, and thank you also to you, our listeners, for tuning in. Keep an eye open for news on the next edition of our podcast, while you can also browse through previous editions of The Best Policy on our website.